You're listening to the Prestige 70 Podcast, a collection of intimate conversations with contemporary jazz artists with an eye toward the genre-defining music made on Prestige Records.
Our guest today is a virtuoso, multi-instrumentalist, songwriter, and producer. He began his career in San Francisco, playing and touring with the great Sheila E. He's gone on to record, write, and produce for a wide range of artists, including, get this list, Jay-Z, Leon Bridges, Lizzo, and Shawn Mendes. He's with us today following the release of his debut album, a remarkable genre-bending work entitled Joy Techniques. Nate Mercero, welcome to the Prestige 70 Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by talking about this album, Joy Techniques, You made a very interesting and very intentional decision to create this album using these guitar synthesizers that were built in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
So how did you come to discover these guitar synthesizers?
Yeah. Well, it was – honestly, I'm a big fan of Pat Metheny.
Uh-huh.
He was actually the first show I ever went to. My dad brought me to a Pat Metheny show. And he always has a part in his performance where he plays that specific guitar synthesizer, the Roland GR-300. And I never really put it together when I was a kid what it was, but as I kind of like started getting together and working in the studio more, finding different sounds, like that sound just kind of kept showing up in my mind.
Yeah.
And I just had to do some research and figure it out. I ended up finding one in some guy's garage in North Hollywood on Craigslist, you know? And picked it up, and it became like a tool for me, like in the studio, to create a world of sound really quickly.
Because
you could blend in guitar tones, synthesizer tones. So really quickly, as just a producer, it became my go-to thing.
Hmm.
And I ended up making a bunch of music just as a result of this new instrument being around.
Yeah. One of the things, you know, obviously, Roland stopped making these years ago. And when I talked to my friends in the guitar world about these synthesizers and told them about this project, they were like, really?
Yeah.
Those were like the hardest, most awkward things to figure out.
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to get comfortable creating with these?
Yeah. There was definitely some time of like really tinkering with it and figuring it out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that was the most exciting time about it, is like when things go a little wrong or do something unexpected, that's the moment I was trying to capture, really. So I kind of started just recording the first interactions I had with the instrument. And a lot of the songs in the record were a lot of first take ideas that I really ended up fleshing out. But it was about capturing those first kind of risky, you don't know what's about to happen with this new thing type moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to come back to that idea because it ties directly to recordings on Prestige, the idea of capturing that first take. Before we get there, and just to kind of put the button on the guitar synthesizers, because I'm a nerd for this.
Yeah.
You've used a phrase describing them, which I found fascinating. You said they have their own dirt.
Oh yeah, for sure.
What does that mean to you?
It's similar with a lot of vintage instruments where they'll do something that's slightly not what it's supposed to do. It has its own character. Like, a lot of older gear was made, you know, to the best of their ability at that time. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things about when things go maybe a little off or a little unexpected or just a little bit not clean. Like, that's the kind of stuff that I like. Like, I like to have to reckon with an instrument a little bit.
Yeah.
It makes me do something different.
You made the record using only these synths. There were no keys.
No keyboards. I did it all with the guitar synthesizers.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, even though we've been talking about, you know, sort of how they've allowed you to expand creatively, if, though, working within boundaries, in other words, your boundary were these synthesizers and your guitar, if working within boundaries somehow counterintuitively allows you to open up even more creatively.
I do find that. Yeah. If you can set some type of like world that you want to explore within, then it's somehow within that you have more of a goal, you know, and you can explore within these confines. And like, at least for me, when I set those rules, it makes me go like, okay, well, maybe I would do something differently as a result of, I'm not going to use a keyboard here. I'm not going to use another instrument. I'm just going to find something unique within this world to do.
Mm. Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Yeah. When I know you worked on this album for quite a period of time.
I did. It was kind of off and on, though.
Yeah.
Because I do a lot of production work for other people. Mm-hmm. So this was really, a lot of the music was made in my, like, apartment at the time. And then I kind of transitioned into a studio. So a lot of it was just music that showed up over time. I didn't even have the intention to make it at first. It just kind of started revealing itself. Like, these, I think, are my tunes. And then I had enough of them that I was like, okay, about at the halfway point, it spilled over into like, okay, we're going to make this a thing.
Yeah.
So it just slowly revealed itself at first.
Again, one of the things, and I think it's indicative in the title,
is the
fact of the joy of creation
as
kind of the overarching theme
to
what you're getting at.
Yeah. Yeah. And like capturing the thing that you are excited to do. It's like all those songs on the record were started just usually by myself, and it was the type of music that I would have the demo on, and it would just play for like 2-3 hours on repeat. And I was like, okay, I know I have something, and no one else in the whole world has heard it. It's just this relationship I have with these sounds at this moment. And I made sure that every song on the record started that way.
Yeah.
And it's like, that was the sign to me that it was something special.
Yeah. And we talked a minute ago about capturing first takes.
Yeah.
And this definitely, you know, to my mind, and I've read about your thinking in this regard, ties back to Prestige.
Yeah.
Because so much of the music made on that label was done based on first takes.
Yeah.
You know, these remarkable musicians would get together in Rudy Van Gelder's parents' living room, which is where he was recording. And Bob Weinstock, you know, would say, go.
Yeah, they wouldn't pay for rehearsal time.
No.
They were just like, go for it.
No.
Right? Yeah.
No, there was no rehearsing. And what I read later was if for some reason they needed to do a second take, he'd erase the first one.
Oh,
because he was saving money on the tape.
Yeah. But he's also like creating an environment that's like, just bring it right now, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a good environment to have in a lot of ways.
Let's you know, kind of transfer this to your thinking. You've produced you know, with all manner of terrific artists, how do you approach kind of capturing that initial moment when everything is fresh?
Yeah. It seems to change depending on the day, the people involved, but I always like to get the first take, even if it's just completely sloppy figuring the song out, singing, whatever. You know, like there's something about the first take, even when you're barely familiar with the material, that is always something, especially with improvised music.
Yeah. I mean, there are stories I've read where, you know, John Coltrane would come in, you know, with a group of guys, and they would go through, you know, whatever it was, a four-hour session or something, and Weinstock would say, we need a blues.
Yeah.
You got one?
Just do one.
and on the spot.
Yeah.
You know, and you listen to it and you go, oh, my God. Not only is it terrific to listen to 50 years later or whatever, but in the moment it had to be.
Right, because you're feeling these people, like, figuring it out. There's an extra bit of, like, either tension or just excitement that really comes through. It's not it's not like a palpable thing. It's more like an ethereal, like, feeling.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So on, you know, in kind of the extension of this discussion is, I think you played something like 7 instruments on this record.
Yeah, I did play almost everything on the record. Right. And I had some drummers come in to help me on the percussion side.
Yeah. Which might lead to kind of an endless amount of tweaking.
Yes, definitely.
And so I'm wondering, is it a challenge to know when you're done?
Yes, for sure. Because like the way I make music is that I'm just doing it every day all the time with, you know, really no intention except trying to make things better, you know? So that's my challenge, honestly.
Yeah.
You just nailed it. It's when are things done?
Yeah.
And it's, you kind of just have to be like, well, it is, you know? You just have to make a choice at a certain point.
But I think many, many artists have said this. The person I remember saying it first was Sting, who said, you don't necessarily finish an album, you abandon it.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of sad.
Which is sort of the negative way of looking at
it. But I get it, though, because you just kind of have to be like, I've done what I can do. Like, anything beyond this, and I'm actually kind of tainting the process. You know, you're making it something it's not.
Yeah.
And a record, if you just think of the word of it, it's like a record of time in your life. It should just represent that. And if as long as it does that, then it's doing its job.
Right. There's a song on the record, and I'm probably going to butcher the name.
Sure.
Zalatwich?
Oh, yeah.
Did I get the name right?
I honestly wish I could pronounce it correctly. Yeah. I think it's Zalatwich.
Okay.
It's a Polish word.
Yeah.
And I'm sure someone's going to hear me say that. It's not that either.
We may get you know, mail on this.
Yeah, I would appreciate it, though.
Yeah, right. But you tell me what it means.
Well, so half of my family is Polish, and I haven't really gotten the opportunity to dive into that part of my heritage, but I'm kind of fascinated with words that don't translate to English. There's a lot of them out there.
Yeah.
But this one in particular was a word that means basically something to the effect of, we're doing things not by official means. We're going to do it with our friends, or we're going to do it kind of behind the scenes, and we're going to get it done. Don't worry about it. And that felt really cool to me at the time, because I was starting my own record label, and I was starting to put out this first album, and I was doing it with my friends, and it really felt like the word just kind of showed up. I don't even remember where I first saw it. I must have been just cruising the internet or something, and then it just popped out, and that just felt like a good metaphor for kind of how I was doing things.
Yeah, kind of a Polish version of "We Got This."
Yeah, it's like that, and even when you perform the music live, it's a good feeling too, because it's like, we're here with our friends. We're not doing this through like some type of official means. It's just us hanging out, you know, and doing it. And there's probably a more like defined version of that word that I don't know, but that's like the meaning that I took from whatever I remember.
You mentioned your record label.
Yeah.
Howso Records.
Yeah, Howso.
And another great phrase that I read that you used about the label, you called it a record label for seekers.
Yeah. And that's kind of, honestly, just a reference to how I think of music, you know, which is, there's not really a genre in mind for the label. It's really just doing things that I think are radical or creative. Mm. Like, I'm not super concerned with having a through line of style. I just want a through line of intention, just making things that are interesting.
Yeah. I go back to the music made on Prestige. And while I'm sure Bob Weinstock would have described his label differently than you describe yours, the reality is it's the same thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you look at like, I mean, I was just looking through the vinyl out there, and it's like the amount of different experiences you have in records out there is like amazing.
Yeah. You know, the bebop at the time was expanding the jazz art form. It was, you know, kind of a reaction to big band. And really, the musicians, were bringing the audience along with them.
Yeah.
You know, they were kind of, you know, the audience was coming because they were going to this new place with these remarkable artists.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's how you feel about Joy Techniques and your record label.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to think that. You know, that's the idea. It's like, it's just like the idea of saying something, or I always come back to this idea when like you had a question in class. I remember the teacher would always just be like, just raise your hand and ask the question, because someone else probably has that question.
Yeah.
I think music is a lot like that, where it's like if you just want to say something or you want to do something and you want to present an idea, just do it to the most honest, pure, best of your ability. And if you can do that, the people will, even if they don't know they wanted it, will be like, oh, I feel you, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like that's kind of what it's about.
Yeah. How important is the audience-creator relationship? In other words, as you're making this album in particular, are you thinking about presenting it to an audience, how this would work in a live context?
A little bit, yeah. That's kind of constantly a line to draw in the studio, though.
Yeah.
Right? It also moves a lot.
Mm, I'm sure.
Because there's a lot of music to be made without thinking about the audience. Because if you go too far out of like what is meaningful to you, then you're kind of just in the void of no man's land, and you're making things off this projection of what you think somebody will enjoy. You know, so I find that you can connect with the most people the more you can actually connect with yourself.
Mm.
Or even just the other people in the room. If you can really get on board with the people you're making things with, then it's almost just like a vote of confidence that what you're doing is going to resonate somehow.
Yeah, that feeling, yeah. That feeling translates.
Yeah.
One of the other things, and this is something that even going back to the days when Prestige was recording all these remarkable musicians,
yeah.
is jazz has always fought this impression that it is in some way esoteric, that it is elitist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, even though in the days of Prestige, these were African-American guys who were saying, no, 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 this is ours.
Yeah,
we
absolutely,
got a thing.
Dude. Yeah.
You know, we got a thing. But that whole issue of being academic, is that something that you fight against when you make your music?
Yeah, there is something about jazz that has been it's taught in schools now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a lot of music is, though.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be people who consider themselves purists or that they only want something that is referencing this classic era that they really appreciate, you know. But the musicians who are often making the music don't even consider their music jazz. They're just making things that they think are interesting, you know. And then you can leave the classification up to other people, you know.
Yeah. An artist recently told me that, you know, she felt pretty strongly that genre was basically invented as a means to sell music.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me still, though. I'm not saying I'm anti-genre or something.
Uh-huh.
Like, I love looking at, like, the very, like, various ways different music has, you know, influenced each other and come together, you know. But ultimately, yeah, it's a way to categorize something that might not be so easily categorized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also struck me that there's a track on the record, Get Involved.
Yeah.
Was that you giving yourself a pep talk?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How so? Explain a little bit.
That phrase started to mean a lot to me because I was just moving to LA, and it was like moving to a new place can be tough, and just like getting involved in the music scene. And that phrase just kept coming up. If I didn't want to go out to the jam or I felt like I was kind of just not a part of anything, it was like a bit of like, just go and get involved and be a part of it. And it worked, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, just show up and make the place your home.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm at now.
I want to talk a little bit about your career arc.
Yeah,
because it's been super cool. I mean, going from, you know, writing and playing, producing for other artists to, you know, ultimately kind of leading your own project.
Yeah.
What was your mindset in terms of making that transition, or did it kind of happen organically?
Yeah, I actually wouldn't call it so much of a transition. Mm. I think of the music career as like just branches on a different tree.
Mm.
Sorry, different branches on the same tree.
Yeah.
Like the artist's career and putting out my own record is not to take over work I do with other people. It's just another thing that I'm going to start doing.
Yeah.
I'm influenced a lot by people who are in music who just do completely wildly different things constantly. Like, I love that. Like, Brian Eno is a big one for me.
Yeah.
And
oh
that
my gosh.
He's a producer.
Yes.
He makes some of the most, like, you know, kind of esoteric ambient music. You know, he does everything in between. And I love that.
Yeah.
Like, just to occupy all that different space, that's what it's really about to me, is the variety.
Mm.
So this is kind of a part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Brian Eno.
Yeah.
We see some of this, you know, with artists on Prestige, this progression.
Right.
And I'll use John Coltrane,
you
know, as an example, who went from an unknown, basically, sideman to a significant, you know, sort of lead as a band member.
Yeah.
And then ultimately to leading, you know, his own groups.
Yeah.
The final track on your album, See God, Bear Your Soul, Ascend Straight to Heaven.
Yeah.
You know, you're, in my mind, you're making this remarkable spiritual connection to the act of creation.
Yeah.
Coltrane, and you know, not in any way to embarrass you, but Coltrane did the same thing. I mean, he ultimately found this spiritual place for his music.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how much of John Coltrane did you listen to?
Quite a bit, yeah. And his, especially later career stuff, affected me in that specific way.
Yeah.
Where he was searching for just something greater through music. And for him, it was like a connection with God, whatever that meant to him, you know. And A Love Supreme, you know, is really that.
Yeah.
You know, and even down to the way I wrote that piece, mm-hmm. it was thinking of artists like him mm-hmm. and Pharoah Sanders and Alice Coltrane too. It might not sound like them really, but the intention behind it was, you know, really branched off from Coltrane mm-hmm. and that just that type of thinking about the music, like really letting the music be special and be spiritual and don't be ashamed of that. Just like go there with it.
Yeah. Because I think any artist would tell you, and again, the quote that comes to mind, somebody asked Keith Richards once how he came up with these memorable riffs, things that people remember for decades. And he said, you know, I don't so much create them as I receive them.
Yeah, I hear that too. If you like become a musician who is proficient enough with your instrument mm-hmm. and you could just get in touch with being in the moment, that's kind of how it feels. It's mm-hmm. just like you're just there for it. Like I got the chance to talk to Herbie Hancock one time and mm-hmm. he said something similar. Yeah. We were asking him like, what was it like to be making these records like Headhunters and stuff? And he almost blew it off and was just like, I was just there, man. You know? And it's like, I love that so much because it's like, yeah, you were there and you were the person who was able to execute and share that idea.
Right.
You know,
right.
But to kind of allow it to be part of this more ethereal music that already exists that you are more of a channel for, mm-hmm. you know? I don't know how spiritual I actually feel about whatever that is, but there's something happening where if you're prepared and you're there for it, it can show up and you can be the messenger.
You've used another phrase, and I'm wondering if it connects to this somehow, about making music that's relevant to your surroundings.
Oh, yeah. I kind of got that from Miles Davis, to be honest, because like when he would, in the 80s, start using just all the instruments that were around him, he got a lot of flack from whatever the critics were at the time, or even audience members, like for covering Time After Time or something.
Yeah.
But it made so much sense to me to just like, if you're not making music with the technology or even just the cultural significance that's around you in some way, then it's kind of not that relevant. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes sense to just be a part of what life is like now.
Yeah.
Luckily for me, I'm a part of everything leading up to now. So in my mind, everything in the past is also still relevant. So it's like I have the luxury of being able to mind the past in a very specific way, you know, and also bring it into a current context.
Yeah. And also given where we are with technology, your ability to access.
Oh, the access is huge. It makes so much of a difference. I'm so lucky to have come up. Like the internet was just really kicking off like when I was in middle school. Mm-hmm. So it was like I was still buying CDs. I was going to the CD store and like picking out records just based off the cover, you know? And I do love that experience.
Still a great way
it totally is.
To buy records.
I love that experience.
Yes.
And then it transitioned into I was able to spend the time on the internet and just YouTubing things I would never have access to now.
Yeah.
And, sorry, never had access to then.
Then.
Yeah. And it really influences, like, the way I make music because there's no rule. It's just everything's available, so let's utilize it.
Yeah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What, yeah. So, last question about joy techniques,
sure,
and then I want to talk about some other stuff. But you know, the idea of making music that sustains, you know, because I think many artists would tell you that, you know, the one thing that they would like to do is make music that people remember for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And that transcends, you know, era and genre and all these things we've been talking about. And I think you could certainly make the case for what's been heard on Prestige has...
Oh, absolutely.
You know, transcended.
No question. Yeah.
And I'm wondering for you, is that in your head or are you just doing what's here and worrying about that later?
Yeah. I think if I project too far into the future, I get stressed. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm like, what are people going to think in 15 years? It's like I try to not get too far out of my actual feeling and connection with the music myself. And I just have to trust that connection and my taste or my feeling about the music that I'm making at the time is just what it's meant to be.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just musically, structurally, it's like melodies often are the things that really transcend in my mind for me. Like, that's the thing that I remember if I like think of a Miles Davis record from, you know, Prestige. Mm-hmm. It's like I can actually just summon the melody in my mind, you know? So that thing, kind of no matter what aesthetic you put on it, that is, for me, what transcends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to go a little bit back in your career. And I mentioned that you played and toured with Sheila E.
Yeah.
How did you come to meet her?
So I was in the Bay, San Francisco, just playing around town. Like, I was going to college up there. Mm-hmm. And I was getting into the scene, just playing locally, everything, bars, weddings, just whatever, you know, like, and I met a few musicians in town and got on the radar of a buddy who's now a buddy of mine, this guitar player named Errol Cooney. And he's a Bay Area dude too. And this guy was so instrumental in my career. I tell him every time I see him, and he's just like, whatever. But like, I was a sub for him on Sheila's gig. He was, I actually read about him in like Guitar Player magazine in high school. So it was just this whole trip that I actually got to meet this dude. Yeah. And he just called me to sub the gig last minute. And it was like, well, I can't do it. Like, I heard you're a guitar player in the Bay who could handle this. And I was just like, yeah, sure. I can't say no. And I showed up to rehearsal, which was the day of the gig. We were playing this place called Yoshi's in Oakland.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was pretty much losing my mind because I had never been called for anything that was this intense musically, and just like to be called for a gig that was like there was just a status element to it. I was like, wow, Sheila E., like Prince, you know, there's just so much about that that is so legendary to me. And so we start at like 10 a.m. that day and the gig's that night. And you walk in the room and it's Bobby G's playing guitar. And Levi Caesar is also playing guitar. So we had three guitars. And nobody told me they're on the gig. So I'm just like blown away at these two legends, you know. And Sheila is obviously there. And Eddie M, also from Prince, is on sax. And Raymond McKinley, like these are all like Prince alumni, you know. So nobody told me. So I walk in and I'm just like kind of starstruck by these musicians that I've like watched on Sign of the Times or whatever. And it ends up just being the most supportive group of people. You know, they're just so nice and they're excited about me being there, you know, and I was excited to be there. So it just like, me and Levi just started playing some kind of like, almost like church gospel quartet groove together just to sound check. And then it was off from there. It was like, you know, we just learned I'd been learning the music. We played the whole set a few times and I literally held on to that gig for like 5 years after that. Also, a buddy of mine, a guy named Mike Blankenship, got the gig with me, and we had been playing around town too. So we really felt like we're like let's do this, man. Like let's make this our thing, you know. And it worked out, and we traveled the world. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
She, as you mentioned, I mean, she clearly comes from the Prince sort of, you know, school of musical preparation. Tell me about rehearsing.
Yeah.
With her.
12 hours, you know.
12 hours.
We did a few of those. Like that's kind of the legend of Prince too, is like play the same groove for 8 hours or you don't know how to play it. That's just that type of mentality, like really getting into the idiosyncrasies of the most simple things you could do in music. And, you know, Sheila really brings that to her band too. It was such a learning experience. You were talking earlier about working at Tower and just getting this like really kind of maybe informal education, but the most important one, that's how it was with Sheila. Like she really brought out of me just the type of playing that's like, if you're going to play something, you better stick it and really mean it. You know, and we're all on the same team here, but like, I'm on you, you know? And it's a good thing. She's like really influential and special to me.
I love the attention to detail, you know, because, you know, like they say, the devil's in the details, and it applies to music too.
Definitely. And then what was interesting was to like do those rehearsals really like, oh my God, like at the end of the day, you're just exhausted, you know? But then you go on tour and you're playing the music and you're just like, wow, I've never felt so confident. Like we are really nailing it. It really felt like we're in a great band, you know? And it's a good feeling.
That's fantastic. How'd you come to work with Jay-Z?
Jay-Z was through No ID, a producer. And that was through another friend, a guy named Steve Weierman, who is a guitar player, producer. He is No ID's like go-to musician. He plays on all these records from Jay-Z, Rihanna. You just look at No ID's discography. Almost all of it for the last 10 years has this guy Steve playing guitar, and he's a great friend of mine. So he would just often call me like, hey, come through the studio, we're working on this beat, or we're doing a sample replay. I honestly didn't know it was for Jay-Z at the time, at least when we started. And then we were working on this, just kind of adding some music to the sample. It ended up being for the song Marcy Me. And we were simultaneously replaying some stuff, but adding some like synthesizers, some guitars, some bass. And, you know, then while I was there, they're like, oh, this is going to be for Jay-Z, and he's next door. And they're like, oh, awesome.
You didn't know he was...
Yeah, I didn't really know at the time, you know, at least great. When I got called for it. It was really just me and Steve just kind of like doing our thing, and it ended up... It's kind of funny how often that happens in music. Mm. You'll just be making something, and it ends up a place that you would never have guessed. Yeah. I honestly didn't even get... I was never in the same room with Jay-Z. It was me and Steve and No ID working on the beat. Hmm.
Another person that you've mentioned that you've called him a mentor, Ricky Reed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about, because I think you met him in the Bay Area and then reconnected with him here.
Yeah. We've got kind of a detailed history, I guess. I had a band in the Bay called The Park. We had a weekly residency. We were just playing for 5 years every week at this spot called The Royale. Ricky had a group called Wallpaper at the time, and my band was very open to just backing other artists up. That's what we wanted to do. We just wanted to work with the whole scene. Ricky was one of those people. We met through the Royale, also a studio in the Bay. You might know Different Fur Studios.
Yeah.
Which was a real hub for just a lot of musicians. And we met through that scene between the Royale and Different Fur. And we just kind of started playing live together. We were backing him up when he was pursuing that part of his career. And I joined his other band, Face in New York, for a couple shows. It was very, like, you know, casual at first, just kind of musicians jamming. He came down here years before I did. Then I moved down. I was still very, like, tour guy, just, like, hired gun musician. We reconnected through some studio sessions, working on a Kesha record. He was like, dude, if you ever want to leave the road, let me know. I didn't quite know what that meant at the time, you know, but it was... I ended up quitting my main touring gig at the time, and within, you know, a couple days, Ricky was like, let's work full time. Let's like get on board here. You know, let's get the publishing deal together and like, let's like dive in. Cause those like little sessions we did, we like, when we reconnected, we're like, oh, we got a thing going on, you know, and we've been cruising ever since. It's been a couple years at least, you know.
And you've had the opportunity to write and produce with, as I said in the open, some remarkable artists, but from completely different, like, you know, creative sensibilities and sound, whether it's Lizzo to Leon Bridges to Shawn Mendes.
Right.
Tell me about kind of, you know, how you found your way as a collaborator working with these kinds of artists.
Yeah. It's endlessly interesting because every artist is different, clearly, but even the people within their crews are all different too. So it's like finding your way in that can be, at least for me, it was a little bit like relearning how to exist as a musician, because when you're playing live, it's like you're really trying to deliver in a very specific way. It's like it's for this exact moment for you and the crowd and for us together. So being in the studio and kind of taking on more of a role of, oh, I can offer some lyrics. I can offer some production ideas. I can engineer. I can, you know, start to utilize those skills. And like I said earlier, the variety is the thing. So like when there's always something new, it's like, okay, how can I exist in this space? Like my real like goal in doing it at first was just like, okay, what needs to be done? I'll just do it. And I ended up doing some things I maybe shouldn't have been doing as a result of that, like vocal producing, you know, at the time was like, I often just say yes and then figure it out, you know? So a lot of like how I figure to work with different people in different situations is just still with that mentality. Like what needs to get done, I'm down.
Mm. You know? Tell me about, because I'm interested in this, tell me a little bit about the difference between producing vocals, because I've heard this from others as well. Producing vocals is...
Yeah,
I was talking to somebody not too long ago who said, it was Luther Dickinson from the North Mississippi All-Stars.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking about, you know, he's produced other artists. And he goes, man, yeah. You get the vocal right, you're 97% of the way there.
It really is true, especially in a pop context, you know, like getting the vocal right is, I mean, I've learned so much from Ricky Reed about that. Mm. It's like creating an environment where everyone's comfortable, where you can fully express the meaning of the song. You know, maybe we're even talking about why we're here. You know, it really gets almost therapeutic sometimes in those places. Like, it's very intimate too, because you're like in the headphones with the people, you know, you're talking in their ears, like they're emoting something that you either wrote together or they wrote themselves. So it's really a detailed process. It's like, it really comes down to a lot of like, kind of just the relationship you can have with the person and the music very intimately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So continuing on the vocal producing.
Yeah.
I recently had the opportunity to sit down with Tanya Tucker and Brandi Carlile and Shooter Jennings. So Brandi and Shooter produced Tanya's recent record.
Yeah.
And Tanya was telling the story that the vocals, all the vocals that she did on that record were with Brandi literally sitting in the vocal booth with her.
Wow.
I mean, like so much as, you know, like tapping her on the knee.
Yeah. See, that's the stuff. Yeah.
And she said, first of all, I've never had anybody do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And looking at it from the outside, you think, wow, that is an incredibly sort of, you got to trust that person.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's that intimate, you know, and if that's what it takes to have the performance be what it needs to be, that's what you do, you know. With Leon, I was in the room a lot for his vocal performances, and Ricky was engineering and really vocal producing. I was kind of there for moral support, you know.
Yeah.
But like for him, it was like, it was actually that last record we did, it was all just in the control room, like speakers blaring with a SM7B, like just because that was the vibe and it was fun,
yeah.
You know, and it got us to all be in a place where it's like, this is the vibe that the record needs, so this is what we're going to do, even though it's completely unorthodox and almost silly, you know, how lo-fi that actually is. But it's all those range of experiences, you know, really matter.
But I would imagine some of that has to do with if the artist is comfortable.
Oh, for sure. That's really the
bottom line. This
is what
we do.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Shawn Mendes is like that too. Like I get a lot of opportunities to watch people who are really good at it. Teddy Geiger produces Shawn Mendes.
Yeah.
And she is also really good at just creating this incredibly like light environment, you know, just to be yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I was gonna ask you about her because you've said that she's one of the most inspiring people.
Definitely.
That you've ever met. And tell us why.
Yeah. She's one of those musicians that, coming to LA from the Bay, I was like, cool, I'm a guitar player. I can play guitar. You know, and then you meet these musicians who are like, they play guitar, they engineer, they produce, they write lyrics, they play piano, they play drums. And you're like, oh, wow, okay, I get it. Like, the idea of being a great musician is like, way more all-encompassing than just being proficient at one instrument. And Teddy's like that.
Yeah.
And she's just a beautiful person.
Yeah. You know, and go with me on this. This is not me speaking. This is just, you know, sort of the conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
Some
yeah.
people might say
yeah.
about the work that you do in pop is, even though it's soul-sucking, it pays the bills that allow you to do, you know, whatever you want to do personally in a creative sense.
Mm-hmm.
But if I understand correctly, that is not how you look at it.
No, not really. You know, there is always something to pay in the bills, for sure.
Yes,
like,
no
you
question.
Can't deny that.
No question.
But I don't really look at working with pop artists as like, there's no soul sucking involved, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like these people just want to make something that relates to them that they think is good, you know? And if that happens to be pop music, then that's just what it is.
Mm.
It's not like they're trying to pull the wool over the audience's eyes and make something stupid, you know? It's like, it's all high level stuff.
Yeah.
Some of the greatest musicians I've met are in this pop context. It's like, it's not so much that I have even a delineation between it. It's like, it's just, oh, this is what we're doing today? Great, let's make it the best we can.
Go do it.
Yeah, and that could be, you know, a pop record. It could be, you know, the most intense fusion jazz record. It could be ambient music. Like, anything, if you bring the level of like just understanding of what it is and doing your best you can to make it more what it is, then there's nothing about it that needs to be delineated.
Yeah.
It's all just music.
What have you taken from your experiences working with these different artists and applied back either creatively or in a production sense and applied back to your own work?
There's definitely some things that I've probably picked up even just not even knowing.
You
just watch people work and it's like, oh, that's how you do it. And it just internalized immediately, you know? And there's a lot of what I take is probably just the general vibe. Mm. Like if you're working with someone who is just inspired to work or just to make something, kind of no matter what it is, I'm always like, yes, you know, thank you. It really like helps me like remember what it's like and why you love music and why you like working on it.
What is it you think makes you a good collaborator?
It would probably be that I'm kind of down to do whatever. If I'm in a room and there's, you know, a bunch of great musicians, I'm so happy to just do whatever needs to happen. Mm. You know, I'll play bass, I'll play guitar, I'll hang out, I'll make some coffee, like whatever. Yeah. Like just being around that, you know, inevitably things will happen and you'll pass instruments around, people will get behind the computer, whatever, you know. I like that.
We were talking earlier that you're planning on, you know, kind of taking some of this music out next year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What are you doing now?
Right now, we have a residency in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. We play every first Sunday at this place called The Virgil, and we're really trying to make it a thing. It's really my label's night, and it just happens to be my record is out right now.
Yeah.
So my band is the one that's really performing. But, you know, as we put out more and more records, that's going to be the home for it, you know, and we're going to take them on the road, too. We got a trio to play the record because it's all guitar synth, so it's kind of interesting to figure out how to perform it live because I could get, you know, 10 guys or girls to play guitar synths with me, you know, and like have a 3-drummer setup, you know.
Robert Fripp's League of Crafty Guitarists.
Absolutely, yeah. But that's, you know, I like the trio context. There's something about like a classic guitar organ trio, kind of like Grant Green and like Wes Montgomery used to do with like an organ player, a drummer, and guitar, but instead of an organ, we're using synthesizers. So it definitely approximates the sound of the record. And then we live within the sound of the album and then explore from there.
Yeah. Well, the album is called Joy Techniques.
Yeah. It's
fantastic.
Thank you.
We very much appreciate you taking the time. Thanks,
thanks
for being
so much for having me. This
on
is
the
great.
Prestige 70 podcast.
Yeah,
Nate
thank
Mercer.
You, Scott. Yeah.
You'll find additional episodes of the Prestige 70 podcast at craftrecordings.com/Prestige70 or wherever you download podcasts. This episode was brought to you by Craft Recordings, crafting the future from the past. Edited by Zach Stilwell and produced by Laura Saez, I'm Scott Goldman. Thanks for listening.